I think it's time to get started. So, welcome to the Skip, can you get your table's attention, please? Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. I'm David Alkeck, and I'm president of this organization. It's been going on for over 40 years, trying to bring intellectual knowledge or whatever, education to North Texas. Are there any new people, new... Yes. Where'd you hear from us about us?
Meetup.com.
Okay. Oh, yeah, Meetup. Okay. Anybody else? Well, welcome. I hope you enjoy it. And a little housekeeping things. Make sure that you pay for your food. Don't walk that out. And take care of your server. You know, they have to live on their tips, too. So,
David.
Yes, and the admission tonight is $5. If you're a full-time student, then it's only $2. But we do have our expenses too. So, David Drum is our treasurer. See him if you haven't already taken care of that. So tonight we have with us Dr. James Mueller. Professor and I am told interim associate dean because he doesn't want to do administration. He wants to really be a teacher, and I don't blame him. He was born in Columbus, Missouri. Is that right? Columbia, Missouri, sorry. And grew up in St. Louis. Is that right? His wife is also from Missouri. They're both from the Show Me State, right? Got his master's and master's degree from in journalism from the University of Missouri and a PhD in journalism from the University of Texas, Austin. Great school. Has been at UNT since 2000 in the department there. Worked as a newspaper reporter, photographer, and editor for about 10 years before entering academe. So he is the author of 3 books, named a finalist in nonfiction in 2014 by the Western Writers of America. Specializes in writing about the 19th century press and presidency and the history of journalism? Yeah. So without any further ado, Dr. James Mueller.
Okay. Is this working?
Now it is.
Now it is. Okay. You all hear me?
Yeah.
All right. Great. Thanks for inviting me. It's really it's a great honor to be here in front of such a distinguished guest. And believe it or not, journalism or college professors really don't have that much of a chance to really talk philosophically. You know, most of our conversations with students are along the lines of, is that going to be on the exam? Or something like that. So this is kind of a treat for a college professor to talk to an audience that really wants to engage deeply in the topic. And I think the topic that we're going to talk about tonight is a really important one. It's a really serious one, this discussion about fake news. Because it's an interesting time. It's a critical time for journalism, for the profession I work in, because this debate about fake news has damaged the credibility of journalism even further than it has been. And it's been on the downslide for a long time. It's one of the professions that every year when Gallup does a survey, what institutions do people trust the most? The one that usually comes out on top is the military. And journalism, the last 5-10 years, has been ranked kind of towards near the bottom with Congress and other groups like that. So people lack trust in the media, and it's getting worse with this debate over the last year or so about fake news. It's a really serious thing, I think, for our democracy, because when you think about it, the premise of our whole government is based on the fact that people get good information and can make informed decisions when they vote. And if people lack that confidence in the news media, they lack confidence in the institution of democracy, and our whole society is kind of on the downslide. So it's a really, really serious issue. Before I get into it too far, though, and I know some people at other tables were kind of talking about what is fake news, so I thought I'd start off with... Let's see if this... All right, and there we go. Okay, start off with a story. I don't know if anybody saw this recently in the media. Kind of topical, you know, from last week. Anybody see this? Some people maybe saw something like it. President Trump ordered the execution of turkeys previously pardoned by Obama. Is that a true story?
No.
How many people? True?
No.
A little bit skeptical? I don't know. Okay, it is a fake news story. It's not true. Although when I've been sharing it with people the past week and said something like, hey, I read that the president ordered the execution of previously pardoned turkeys, some people said, really, you did that? And there was enough kind of doubt that some people, you know, in the partisan era we are in right now, were willing to believe that. The interesting thing is that the story has a grain of truth in it. It's from a joke, a satirical website called Real News Right Now. Okay? And if you go to this website, it looks like a real web newspaper with headlines and pictures and so forth. And you think that it's a real site until you start reading all the different story headlines. Like today I checked it, and there was a story about the controversial election in Alabama. The people following that with Judge Roy Moore. Okay, they had a headline from that that said, Roy Moore says he can't help the fact that his Chuck E. Cheese cowboy hat is a chick magnet. And it has a picture of him in his cowboy hat, but it has the Chuck E. Cheese logo superimposed on his hat, you know, from the kids' pizza parlor. Okay? And so you're thinking, nah, that's not true, is it? You know? And then there's another headline, again, about the president. Trump says he does not believe that Putin stuck a kick me sign on his back during the Asia summit. And it has, again, a picture of the president shaking hands with somebody, and then there's a hand digitally altered putting a kick me sign on Trump's back. So if you go through this, then you think, well, okay, well, this is a joke website. And if you go to the about description on the website, it gives the editor's information, and it says that he's an expert in almost everything, so you get a little bit more suspicious as a picture of a guy. And then finally, it says that he's won the Oscar Mayer Award for distinguished journalism. And then the last kicker is that he won the Stephen Glass Award for distinguished ethics in journalism, which, if anybody, is kind of an inside joke for journalism, because Stephen Glass is a famous fabulist and plagiarist who was fired from as a magazine editor. So anyway, this story was on that website. Again, it has kind of a grain of truth, because when Trump did pardon Drumstick and what was the other name of the guy?
Wishbone.
Drumstick and Wishbone, he did say offhand to the reporters, everybody knows I'm revoking Obama's presidential orders, and I checked with the Justice Department whether I could revoke last year's pardons of Tater and Tot, and the Justice Department said I couldn't. So there was a little bit of truth to that, but then, like most humorists, they will take it and exaggerate it and go a little bit too far. So, you know, people have been asking, what is fake news? Is that fake news? I think you could say it's fake news, but it, you know, was it intended to harm? Was it part of the controversy over whether Russia is interfering with the election or somebody else in the terms of its stories really out to destroy democracy? Maybe not. Really, the intent was a joke. And so in that sense, I think it's really, really hard to define fake news. It's a really malleable term. It's like I think somebody at another table was saying, something along the lines of, it's what I say it is. It's a story I don't like. You know, scholars have tried to define it. People in education are already doing studies on this, and so scholars have to have a firm definition. What is fake news? And some of the definitions I've read are that they're a news or a story that's written in the fashion of a news story, made to look like a news story, but it's false with the intent to deceive. Well, by that definition, this is, you know, fake news. It's meant to deceive. It's meant to fool. But, you know, I don't think it's of the level of something that, you know, people are talking about with the controversy with Russia and so forth, interfering with the election. And so actually, in my own viewpoint, I think fake news is a fad, or it's kind of a buzzword, because it's grown to mean anything that I want it to mean, basically, stories I don't like. In fact, I was asked this at a panel last week. We had the National Communication Association in Dallas, and we were talking about fake news. And somebody asked this question, is it a fad? And I think it is. Because, in a sense, it's hard to define, so it's something people are talking about now, but it's also something that's really nothing new, in the sense that throughout American history, we've always had fake news. We've always had hoaxes in American newspapers. One of the most famous ones from the 1830s was the New York Sun said that they had found men on Mars, that somebody looked through a telescope and found men, and they had elaborate stories on this, and people believed it for a while. And the very first American newspaper published even before the United States was a country, in 1690, Public Occurrences, the back page was left blank. And that was left blank intentionally so that people could add their own news and just fill in their news and pass it around a coffee shop. And it's kind of like Facebook now, you know, where people add their own commentary and pass news around. So it's nothing new. It's a phenomenon that we've had for many, many years. It's just it's become kind of a buzzword right now that there's this fake news floating around everywhere. That sometimes, you know, fake news could be just the media reporting rumors, something they're not really sure is true. This picture, this gentleman here, is a guy named Wilbur Story. And he was the editor of the Chicago Times during the Civil War. And the Civil War, one of the biggest news stories in American history, he sent tons of newspaper reporters out to cover the war, and he gave them the instructions, send all the news you can. And if there's no news, send rumors. And so basically he was saying, send everything. And for many years, you know, American newspapers would say, this is a rumor. We don't know if this is true. But this is what we've heard, you know, take it or leave it. So we've had this for many, many years. I think right now it's become somewhat exacerbated in our mind and maybe become kind of a buzzword or a fad because of digital media, because of Facebook, because of social media, because so many people can act as a journalist and spread stories. And they can take something like I did with the story about Trump, send it to somebody else, don't say that it's from a joke website, and then it can be passed around and people might believe it. Again, as I said, almost everybody can be a journalist now. You know, my daughter is a senior in high school, and she has a blog, a fashion blog, and she's got more than 2,000 followers. And so she writes about fashion, and she has people around the country reading her opinions on fashion. This is a tremendous amount of power for a teenager. And, you know, multiply that through everybody around the country, and you can see how fake news has become a phenomenon or a criticism over what is news. A lot of the stuff I think that we see that people will say, well, that's fake news or it's not true, it's a confusion over what is news produced by professional journalists and news or stories that are just circulated by people who are not trained to be professional journalists and have little or no ethical standards or a sense of what journalists are supposed to be doing. What I thought that I would do a little bit of tonight was to talk about ethics in journalism and how professional journalists are trained. You know, what are the ethical standards for journalists? And I've heard people before say, well, that's an oxymoron. Journalists have no ethics. But actually, you know, professional journalists, people who go through a program like the one I went through when I was an undergraduate at the University of Missouri, and where I teach at North Texas, ethics is part of the curriculum. It's what they teach. It's what students learn. It's what we hope that they practice when we leave the school. Again, we have no control over whether they practice or not. But in ideal terms, this what I'm going to talk about is what journalists consider to be their important principles. And some of this stuff, again, a group like you, I apologize if you know a lot of these terms already, but again, I'm telling you what we teach journalism students and how we practice. And as you probably know, ethics comes from the Greek word ethos, and it represents the culture of a profession, the standards, the traditions. And for American journalists, the main tradition, the culture, is rooted in the First Amendment of the Constitution. And journalists take from the First Amendment that there shouldn't be any government interference in what they do, number one, and then also by implication, because journalism is mentioned in the First Amendment, that we have a really, really important role in the democracy. I think whenever I give a talk like this, I always like to actually present the First Amendment too. I think it's worth reading and talking about again and again, because it's one of these words that's kind of bandied about, and people will say First Amendment, they don't really know what it is, or maybe they read it one time years ago in high school and never again since. But that's the First Amendment to the Constitution. Again, this is where journalists draw their ethical traditions from. And it's Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And journalists take that very seriously. Government will have no law, no control over what journalists do. No law respecting an establishment of religion, prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And journalists take a couple of things from that. One is a sense of humility, you know, in terms of the First Amendment isn't just about journalists. In fact, the first thing mentioned is freedom of worship. So it's not all about the First Amendment, but on the other hand, journalism is really, really important. The press is important because the founders equated it with freedom of worship. So it's one of the most important freedoms we have in the United States, and journalism is one of the most important professions, or at least that's what a journalist would think. Journalists also look to some early philosophers, going back to the Enlightenment. John Milton wrote Areopagitica, one of the classic defenses of freedom of the press and an argument against licensing. And I'm sure some of you probably have read that at some point in school, but when Milton, who's a poet who wrote Paradise Lost, was talking about censorship, he said, though all the winds of doctrine were let loose to play upon the earth, so truth be in the field, we do injuriously by licensing and prohibiting to misdoubt her strength. Let her and falsehood grapple, whoever knew truth, put to the worst in a free and open encounter. And so this is where journalists get the idea that there should be a marketplace of ideas, and that truth will prevail as long as people have access to all kinds of information in the press. And then one of the founders, probably the favorite founder for journalists, Ben Franklin, who was a journalist himself. He was a newspaper printer, started one of the first magazines in the United States. When he was a young printer, he wrote a piece called Apology for Printers, really echoing John Milton, saying that printers are educated in the belief that when men differ in opinion, both sides ought equally to have the advantage of being heard by the public, and that when truth and error have fair play, the former is always an overmatch for the latter. And so again, Franklin was saying this idea that truth will prevail as long as both sides of the public has access to both sides. How do journalists then exercise these tremendous rights that they have? Well, the professions of journalists have developed various codes of ethics over the years. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the ethical standards for journalists. And one of the things, again, about controlling ethics in journalism or getting people to behave and do one thing is that journalists are very independent. They have this culture where there will be no government interference, and then journalists are also tend to be kind of rebellious, not necessarily joiners. Every group that is in the profession of journalism has its own or separate code of ethics. These are just some of the ones I listed. There are many others. SPJ is a Society of Professional Journalists, and they have a code of ethics, which I'm going to talk about a little bit, some of the main points of it. RTNDA, that's a Radio, Television, Digital News Association, they have a code of ethics for broadcasters. Public Relations Society of America, for people who work in the public relations field, they have a code of ethics, and they actually have a certification for ethics, and you have to pass it for being a certified public relations professional. And that part of the test that you take to get that certification is you have to know about the code of ethics. APME, the Associated Press Media Editors, have a code of ethics. That's a group that's aimed at media managers. AAF, American Advertising Federation, has a code of ethics for advertising. WOMA is a really new group, Word of Mouth Marketing Association, that's kind of affiliated with the new creation of social media and folks like my daughter, who has her own blog and then talks to a limited audience, but she gets free clothing and purses and stuff from, I don't know, who sent her one, Target or somebody, or different designers, so that she'll talk about it on her blog. And so there's a Word of Mouth Marketing Association, one of the principles of which is that if you get a freebie and then you write about it on your blog, you're supposed to say, hey, this company, Target or Penny or H&M gave me this purse and I'm writing about it now. Individual media companies like the Dallas Morning News will also use the Society of Professional Journalists, but then have their own code of ethics as well. And so their field is full of codes of ethics. But when we talk about them in ethics classes in the journalism school, we look for commonalities. And the one commonality among all these codes of ethics, no matter which one you're talking about, is to tell the truth. And it's really interesting. People will say, well, public relations, for example, PRSA, Public Relations Society of America, public relations is one of the causes of the fake news phenomenon. I heard that. I mentioned I was on a panel last week, and one of the questions was, well, didn't this all come from PR? Because public relations people will tell lies on behalf of their clients, and they will create fake stories, and that's how it's all started. But actually, the Public Relations Society of America, they're code of ethics, the first point is honesty, and said that you will not lie on behalf of your client. Part of it is because lying is wrong, of course, but also, you know, if you're working in public relations, you're going to kill yourself as a professional if you lie and get caught in a lie, because no one will believe any of your press releases ever again. I mean, it is, public relations is a advocacy type of journalism where you're trying to communicate on behalf of a client, you're telling their story, but according to their code of ethics, you're not supposed to lie on behalf of the client. Same thing for the American Advertising Association, or Federation. People will say, well, advertising is all lies. But again, for professional advertisers, they have a code of ethics that says you will not tell a lie about your product, and you will disclose significant facts that if you lead out would mislead clients. And again, a lot of this is self-interest, because if you're creating ads that lie about a product and you get people to try the product and then it doesn't work, or you've oversold it, you're not going to sell any more of the product. So some of this is self-interest, but also it's wrong to lie. And you see this anyway throughout all of these codes of ethics. The main point in journalism is to tell the truth. I did want to talk again a little bit in a little bit more detail about one particular code of ethics, and that's the Society of Professional Journalists. I thought I'd talk about that as kind of an example of the main ethical principles of journalism, because SPJ is an umbrella group that includes all types of journalism professionals, and it has a fairly simple code, but I think most people in the industry are familiar with the four basic principles of it. Now, I'll use a couple of examples to kind of show how journalists will have ethical dilemmas and how they might try and apply codes of ethics to it. This particular photograph appeared in the Los Angeles Times. Okay, And it shows an American soldier, a couple of soldiers from the 82nd Airborne, and they're posing with the body of a Taliban fighter that they killed in Afghanistan. Okay? And so they're basically disrespecting the corpse, okay, of an enemy fighter. The LA Times got this photo because it was sent along with a bunch of others from a soldier in the 82nd Airborne who said discipline is extremely lax on the base. They're doing stuff like this, messing around with the corpses of Taliban fighters. Somebody is going to get killed, and somebody should do a story about this. And so the LA Times contacted the Defense Department about this, and the Defense Department said, don't publish these pictures because they will cause someone to get killed, because it's going to upset the Afghans. It's going to create more increased bad feelings towards the Americans and lead to more terror attacks. And so the Los Angeles Times editors, reporters debated it all and decided that they would run the photograph anyway. It appeared on the front page. And they then explained their reasoning that their job is to tell the news. If at the end of the day, we realize our job is to publish information that our readers need to make informed decisions, and we have a particular duty to report vigorously and impartially on all aspects of the American mission in Afghanistan. And it fits, again, they were following the first principle in the SPJ code, which has two prongs. It's to seek the truth, and then when you find the truth, to report it. As one of my old journalism professors always used to say, you know, we're in the news business, we're not in the news suppression business. And so when we find out something, we lean toward publishing it if we have a debate. These are some of the subsets. There's actually about 15 or 20 more under this one principle for the Society of Professional Journalists Code under seeking the truth. It's actually kind of interesting, an illustration of how difficult a lot of the ethical debates are in journalism and how it is to craft a code of ethics, because, you know, what is truth? Probably something in your philosophy forum you debated at one time or another. But, you know, in journalistic terms, what is truth? The society is trying to delineate it and say, one, that you have to talk to a variety of sources. If you just get one photograph, for example, from a soldier in the 82nd Airborne, you're not just going to run with that, but you're also going to contact the Department of Defense. You're going to try to talk to a number of other people to try to get closer to the truth. Other things you're going to do, you're going to avoid using anonymous sources. You might have to, on occasion, use an anonymous source if identifying someone might get them killed if you're investigating a drug cartel or something. But in most cases, you're going to let people know who is giving you the information. You're not going to make up stuff. You're not going to plagiarize. You're not going to steal stuff from other people, because that also is a lie if you say, I wrote this story and you didn't. Okay? You don't alter photographs, and that's a big problem today with digital media, and you can move heads on other bodies and all kinds of things. But journalists take this seriously. There's a guy, National Geographic, got fired for taking a shot of the pyramids and the camel and digitally moving the camel closer so it would be in the shot. I mean, it didn't, you know, to the layman it might not mean much, but to a journalist, if you take a photograph, that image is a version of reality, and if you digitally alter it, move things around, you've lied. You've told a lie. Okay? That also, and this gets to the heart of fake news, you distinguish between news and opinion. That if you have an opinion piece and the reporter is making an argument, it's supposed to be labeled as opinion. Okay? It's supposed to be on the editorial page, or if it's on another page, it's supposed to say news analysis or something like that. You're supposed to distinguish between news and advertising. That's why you know, some copy in special sections in newspapers, like the automotive section or a traveler or whatever, they might be written by a travel agency or come from Ford Motor Company or something that might look like a news story. But if the newspaper prints that, then they will label that this information came from Ford Motor Company as a paid news announcement. It's supposed to be labeled. And that you won't just repeat stuff that the government says. If the government asks you to lie, even for a good reason, they want you to you know, lie about a military operation because it would help deceive the enemy. The principles of journalism ethics is that you wouldn't lie even for a good cause, because people expect journalists to tell the truth, again, as near as they can find it. Now, second point to the SBJ code is you're also supposed to minimize harm. And this is actually kind of interesting in terms of that LA Times example, because the argument of the government was if you print this photograph, you're going to harm some people. You could potentially harm some American soldiers. And the SBJ code says you're supposed to minimize harm. So sometimes the principles are in conflict. This, again, it's an illustration of how journalists really have to struggle a lot with what they're doing, and a code of ethics won't solve everything, or ethical principles. You're supposed to balance telling the truth with protecting the safety of sources. The LA Times tried to strike a balance because they said to the Defense Department when they asked them not to print the story, they said, we have to print the story, we have to tell people about this, but we will delay publication so that you can prepare in Afghanistan if you think you need to harden the bases or something like that, if there are going to be more terror attacks or something along those lines. That also, minimize harms means that you're supposed to show compassion for people you interview. And we talk about this a lot in the journalism program, try to get students to realize not to focus just on the creativity. People are really interested, they go into the business, they want to be able to write, and they want to be able to create broadcast stories and tell a story, and you can kind of get caught up in that and think that the people are just kind of like characters in your story. But according to the code of ethics, you have to remember they're human beings and they're not like characters in a Hemingway novel that you're writing, but they're real people. And whenever you can, you need to try to minimize harm to them. And then also that whatever content you use, you're supposed to avoid pandering to the general public. Like you have to consider, like in the case of the LA Times photo, is that picture of the corpse of prurient interest? Is that what, you know, some people call war porn? That people will surf the web to look at violent images of war just because they find it exciting. And it's one of the dark sides of journalism when you realize why some people are interested in certain stories. But it's something that journalists try to be aware of, that they don't want to write stuff just to appeal to people's baser motives. Let's go to a little bit of a lighter topic. Kind of football season. This ties in with another aspect of the journalism code of ethics, what people are supposed to do. This is kind of timely, although it's an old story, but it's one of my favorite ones from teaching at UNT. I was the academic advisor to the student newspaper in the early 2000s. And unlike this year, UNT had really a bad football team for about 30 years in a row. It's one of the worst programs in the United States. And then, lo and behold, in I think it was 2000 or 2001, we had a winning season. Okay, it was the first time ever anybody could remember. And so the students were very excited about it. If we won one more game, we're going to go to a bowl game. But the game was way out west. Memory serves, it was in Idaho. And so the student reporter and photographer, the sports editor and photographer, came to the editor and to me as a student advisor and said, we want to go out to Idaho. It's going to cost, I think it was almost $2,000. Well, we didn't have that in the newspaper budget. And we said, you can't afford that. You're going to have to watch the game on TV, do some phone interviews, and write a story that way. So I don't know who talked to who first, but somehow they talked to the athletic director and said, we're not going to be able to go and cover the game. It's not going to be, you know, the student newspaper, that we're not out there. And so the athletic director said, no problem, I'll buy your plane tickets, I'll buy your hotel, we'll feed you, we'll take you to and from the game, it's all on us, because we want you out there. So they came to the student newspaper, they said, we can go, the athletic department's going to pay for us. And so student newspaper is really their choice. The advisor, me, was just there just to ask obnoxious questions, like I did. Well, doesn't this really violate the code of ethics that we talked about, well, which says act independently? That journalists are supposed to avoid insider relationships. It's not only illegal to do insider stock trading, but for journalists it's an ethical problem if you're using some kind of inside knowledge to write stories if you have some monetary interest in something. And also if you have a conflict of interest that you're being, you're on the payroll of a source. And I posed the question to them, if the athletic department is buying your tickets and paying you about $2,000, what's the difference between you and somebody who works for the sports information department for UNT? Aren't you really a UNT employee? So it created a huge debate in the newsroom. It spilled out into the journalism faculty. We have professors taking different sides, because I remember one longtime professor who worked for the Denton Record Chronicle said, of course they can take the athletic department money. They're UNT students. The athletic department is funded in part by their fees and their tuition. Why shouldn't they have the money? It's their money. And other professors, including me, said, well, yes, but it's an appearance of a conflict of interest. Again, they're basically kind of employees of the university now, because we're not talking about just a ticket to the football game. We're talking about some serious money. It's a couple of thousand dollars if they were going to take these kids out there. So the students decided among themselves, took a vote, and they said, no, we won't take the money because we don't want to be, it to appear that we're on the payroll of the university. The upshot was that after we told the photographer and the sports editor we weren't going to pay for it, they went back and redid their budget, and they said, well, we won't fly, we'll just drive in Joe's car, and all we need is like a couple $100 for gas. And so we gave them that, and they went out and covered it anyway. But it was a useful exercise in what journalists are supposed to do. And again, journalists, part of our ethical principles are we're supposed to be very meticulous about avoiding conflicts of interest with who we cover. Also, speaking about student journalism or any kind of journalism, it's kind of interesting. You know, would you betray a friend, or would you tell about a friend who is violating the code of ethics? I always pose this question to students, and they always say yes, they would turn in a friend or somebody who plagiarized the story. That illustration is probably one of the most famous plagiarists of all time. It's Jason Blair of the New York Times, who made up a ton of stories and then stole stories from other people and caused the New York Times so much embarrassment, they wrote, I think, like a 3-full-page correction explaining all the things that he had done and how they were sorry for him. But anyway, you know, what do you do if you know somebody has plagiarized a story? This comes under the SPJ principle of be accountable. That journalists are supposed to be accountable, admit and correct mistakes. So if journalists do have fake news, or they get a false story because there's a mistake, and that's something, again, that's another, you know, maybe reason for something that's fake news. I think a lot of times people will say, oh, the media made this up to do this or that. But, you know, journalists make mistakes occasionally. You know, we don't really like to admit it that often, mm-hmm. although our code says that we're supposed to. But journalists will make mistakes. Again, the ethical philosophy of journalism is that as soon as you know that you've made a mistake, you correct the story in the next day's edition of the next day's broadcast. That you're accountable to your readers, your viewers, that you explain why you do stories, what your process was. Like in the LA Times, when they ran that controversial photograph, then they wrote you know, a story explaining why they did it. And they knew they would get criticism from their readers. And again, the New York Times, after Jason Blair plagiarized dozens of stories, again, they wrote the longest correction, I think, ever in newspaper history, literally devoting several pages of the paper apologizing and explaining every single story that he had made a mistake in. And journalists take this very seriously. I remember when the Kansas City Star did a story about AIDS in the priesthood, and they did a long investigative piece. This was at the height of the AIDS epidemic in, the mid-80s. And they had done a ton of research looking at death certificates for priests and so forth, and came up with this story making the argument that there was a higher rate of incidence of AIDS among the priesthood than the general population. This created a huge controversy, especially in Kansas City, where there's a large Catholic population. And I heard a speech by the editor of the Kansas City Star, and he described how he himself, a Catholic, was called out by his own priest in the service one day, saying, like, how could you do this kind of story? But he was giving a speech because part of the job is to be accountable. And when you write a controversial story, explain it. And the Star wrote many, many stories explaining their reporting process and explaining why they decided to do this, even though they knew it would create pain in a large segment of the population. Again, journalism ethics says that if you do something like that, you're supposed to be accountable and stand up and explain why you did it and explain your process, how you got the stories. Now you're going to expose unethical practices in your own newsroom. If, you know, a plagiarist is caught, and we've had cases like that in the local media as well. I remember one of the Metro dailies had, I think, a movie reviewer about 10 years ago had plagiarized some stories. And on the front page, after this person was let go, they explained, you know, that he had done these types of stories, and that's why he was being let go from the paper and so on. And then lastly, be accountable means you're supposed to be a good steward. You're supposed to be a good steward of, for one thing, your own talents. That's one thing I tell students. They don't necessarily like that, being a good steward, because I always tell them, if you're going to a journalism program in the United States like North Texas, you're relatively privileged. Because, you know, not only are you privileged to be able to attend an American university, you know, compared to people around the world, but also there's, you know, a lot of places they don't have journalism education. And I've taught in Africa and in Mozambique, and they don't have, or at the time I taught there was no university in that country that had a journalism program. And so they were very, very excited to be able to get some journalism training. So if you have the privilege to be involved in this profession, or if you have the talent that you can do it, you should be a good steward of that talent. And I tell students you have to be in class every day, because that's being accountable. And be a good steward also, we say, of the profession of journalism and of the First Amendment. And that's where I think that actually everybody in the United States, the whole society, has a responsibility to be accountable and to help with this fake news conversation that's going on now. But we all have a responsibility. Educators that, like myself, have a responsibility to teach student journalists about ethics, to do it the best we can, to try and get them to follow these principles. But once they leave programs like UNT, or if they enter the media without working in or going through a school like North Texas, they still have to try to maintain high standards in the profession. And not just abandon ethics as just something they learned in college, but try to keep practicing it when they're on the job. And when they fall short, to try to improve again. Because, again, I don't want to say that all journalists follow this all the time. I think that's one of the problems with the controversy over fake news. Some people have never had any ethical training, but they still have a platform with Facebook or whatever. And some people go through a journalism program and then kind of forget about ethics, or the pressures of the profession get to them. But still, I think working journalists have an obligation to try to maintain high ethical standards. And then also, I think the public itself has a responsibility to help fight this trend in fake news. And that is that the public must demand high standards from the media. The public needs to get involved. And, you know, don't be afraid to contact a newspaper, a television station, or whatever, if you think they're not being fair. And certainly in the digital age, it's very easy to send off emails and say, you know, this story is incorrect, I have personal knowledge about this issue, or that I think your coverage is unfair. And then also, you know, vote with your money. Don't subscribe to publications. Don't patronize ones that you think have low ethical standards. Or don't watch or click on news sites or fake news sites or stories like that that are false. Or try to, you know, correct it politely, you know, on Facebook or other social media. If somebody presents something, you could point out, hey, I think that is from a satirical website. And again, I think everybody in society has a responsibility to deal with this, to be media literate. And that's one thing that we're trying to emphasize at UNT now, and we've developed a course in media literacy open to the population, because we think the whole population of the university, not just journalism students, because we think it's an important skill, particularly in the digital age, to be able to evaluate media. And there are just really some simple things that you can do to evaluate news stories. And one is to always, you know, check the source of the story, particularly if it smells wrong. If something like the Turkey pardon, you're suspicious of it, it's pretty easy to track it down and say, okay, this came from a site called Real News Right Now. That sounds true. Let me click on that website, and then you see all the fake stories, and you know it's not a legitimate news source. So you need to evaluate the stuff that you read or people pass on Facebook or what have you. And then also, you know, you can take that one step further, and also, you know, it's pretty easy to Google reporters now and know stuff about them. And different reporters, journalists at different news organizations have different backgrounds. And sometimes, not to say that they're not ethical, but it's kind of helpful to know something about their background. I mean, George Stephanopoulos, who works for, I think, ABC News now, I don't know how many people, are you familiar with what he was in the past? He was Bill Clinton's press spokesman in the early 90s. Okay, you know, how he got to be a journalist, I'm not sure, but he's a professional journalist now. But still, you know, if you see somebody who was a political operative at one time, you know that anything he produces is at least filtered through the lens of, you know, what he was before. And so you can kind of take what he writes with a grain of salt. So it helps to, again, evaluate what you're looking at. And read other stories on the same subject. You know, again, with the internet, it's easy to do. It's easy to look at a variety of news sites and compare them, and then maybe find the truth somewhere in the middle. And then lastly, the thing that you can do is, in the digital age, is read original documents. It's really easy. For example, a president's State of the Union address, you don't have to rely on a newspaper story about it. You can actually go and a couple of clicks see a transcript of the speech and read it yourself and see if you think quotes were taken out of context. So there are many things I think ordinary people can do to kind of fight this trend or fad or what have you in fake news. And I really personally don't really like the term. I think it's kind of a fundamentally undemocratic concept that we have fake news, because the implication is that there's this fake news that's damaging the country, that people can be fooled by a story they see on Facebook, and that's going to send them running off in one direction or this way or that way, that we can be fooled. I personally don't necessarily think we're a nation of fools. I think most Americans have the mental power to kind of sniff out stories and see a story about a turkey party and make a reasoned judgment about it. And so I think everybody working together, I think we can get through this fake news phenomenon. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We're going to have some questions.
Okay.
I failed to mention that we have one more meeting this year. Dr. Cal Gilson is going to speak on the American Dream in History, Politics, and Fiction. That's December the 12th. And here's schedules for those that need them. So we have time for questions and answers.
I have one for you.
Okay.
Start with. I'm a doctor, and doctors, lawyers, realtors, all kinds of professions have their...
Someone said they couldn't hear you.
Can you hear me now? Their standard of ethics.
Okay.
Ways to enforce them, you know, because all of those professions do have their bad actors, whether they have standards of ethics or not, and they're in the news all the time. Do any of these organizations have a kind of a policing thing, a way to slap their, you know, wrists if they kind of go over the boundaries of ethics?
Most journalism organizations that I'm aware of do not have any kind of policing function. They're voluntary organizations. The Society of Professional Journalists, which I belong to, at various times has talked about disciplinary procedures, kicking somebody out of the group, you know, if they violate the code of ethics. But then the lawyers get involved and they're afraid of a lawsuit that would destroy the organization. So that's one of the reasons why SPJ hasn't done it. I think PRSA, which my wife is a member of, they used to have a mechanism where if you got certified as what, an APR, that if you violated the code of ethics, your certification could be pulled. But I thought maybe recently they did away with that. Or can they still remove your certification?
I think they can still revoke your membership, too.
Yeah, revoke your membership at PRSA. So the business group actually is more strict than the journalism group is. But the argument among journalists always comes down to who's going to do the policing. And it goes back to the First Amendment, the idea that there's no government control. And then there shouldn't be any really private control other than the paper or TV station that you're contracted with. And so that's how people are punished. Like Jason Blair is fired by the New York Times and he's never going to get another job in journalism. But again, journalists are always worried who is going to police this. That's why the talk about fake news is also kind of disturbing to journalists, because the implication is, well, there's fake news on Google, there's fake news here. Somebody needs to fix that. Who's that somebody going to be? Well, it's always going to be the government. And that's really antithetical to journalists, that the government is going to fix the news. And they're going to decide what is fake news. Because again, you know, it's really hard to determine what is fake and what should not be permitted. I mean, should the story about the turkeys not be permitted? That's fake news. Okay. Off the website. You know, if the federal government is in control, you know, the administration through the FCC, in theory, could then say any fake news is not going to be broadcast in the United States. Well, if you're the party in power, you enjoy that. You know, if you're a Republican right now, they're in charge of the administration. But what happens if your party, if you're a Democrat, maybe you don't like the Republicans controlling that, and then vice versa. When, you know, Democrats take power the next time, and you're a Republican, do you really want the Democrats then deciding what is fake news and what's up and what's not? So that's kind of a long-winded answer for the rationale why journalists really don't have any formal imposition for that. Yeah.
I want to question your perspective on the student newspaper writers who could or could not go into the district thing. I don't exactly know what they were, what line were they crossing. If they were student newspaper writers,
right,
wouldn't we expect them to be, if you want to say, prejudiced toward their school? Would you expect them to look for flaws in the game because they're perfectly equal to both sides? I don't know why we wouldn't allow a school newspaper writer to be paid by the school to go to the game and report ostensibly, I guess, to the students who would want to know this that happened. I'm sure they wouldn't change the facts of the story, and so I'm questioning what violation were they having.
Well, the issue was, again, the appearance of a conflict of interest, that they would then be holden to the athletic department, that they were getting a substantial amount of money. But they wouldn't be, even though it's a student newspaper, it's North Texas Daily, as far as the news goes, they're supposed to be able to say to criticize the coach. I mean, if the team went and they lost, the students should be free to say, you know, basically the coach is an idiot. Or this player performed really poorly. Or, you know, they could have won if they hadn't done this or that. Or, you know, in today's rules, somebody, you know, does a targeting foul, you know, in football, where you hit somebody helmet to helmet. And, you know, when you're watching that game, and I know as a fan myself, you know, when I see a Mizzou play, and a Mizzou player is targeting, I'm like, ah, that's okay. He's a big baby when he was hit in the head. But, you know, the other team does, and hits the player in the head, and then you want him expelled. So you're rooting for one or the other. But if you're for the student newspaper, even though it's the North Texas Daily, you're supposed to kind of take a step back and write a balanced story. And so the idea is that, well, if you're riding on the plane with the team and you're being paid for, everything is paid for by the team, then, you know, when you interview the coach, when you interview the athletic director, are you going to be really confrontational or ask a difficult question? Maybe you're not going to be as free to do that. It's one of the reasons why, you know, in newspapers, they often will change the beats that people are assigned to. Newspapers are often structured where, you know, you will cover the cops, you know. And the thing is that when you're a newspaper reporter and you're covering City Hall or cops or whatever, you work with these people every day, you see the police officers more often than you do with the people in the newsroom, and then all of a sudden, you kind of become like a police officer and every story is written through their viewpoint. And that's not really what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be there covering the police in a balanced way. Are they being fair and just and so forth? And so newspapers will often move people around so they don't get too close. And so this is that kind of thing. You're, everything you've got, the hotel room, everything, you know, get some room service kit, go ahead. Then, you know, when you interview the athletic director, you know, you're going to be... That, so that's the idea.
We have another question.
Yeah.
Early on, you sort of credited Ben Franklin with the idea that, that we should... That we should present both sides of the story.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that, that journalists, maybe I'm overgeneralizing, have made controversies where they don't exist by presenting both sides of the story. And I'm specifically right now thinking of the climate change controversy. If you look at people that are involved in it, there's no controversy there, and yet it still exists in journalistic sources, newspapers, TV, radio, and so forth. Do journalists have a responsibility not to promote controversies that don't exist?
Well, I mean, that, you know, that was always the argument also with tobacco. You know, does it cause cancer or not? And then journalists will always have another... well, you know, there's quite a debate about guns, though. I mean, you know, whether you're, you know, in favor of restricting gun sales or not, I think if journalists choose one side or the other, you know, there's a strong public opinion about that debate. But yeah, that's a continuing argument within journalism. You know, when is something received public knowledge or there's enough consensus like we don't have to present another side. But, you know, in the climate change debate, you know, there's a fair amount of people, you know, one political party that's on the other side. And so if journalists just say, you know, right out there's no debate on this or people don't have a difference of opinion in the United States, then you're really kind of shutting out part of the public, I would say, or at least part of the political parties and so forth. Climate change is also kind of one of those kind of interesting issues where journalism has a problem where we try and break everything into two sides. But climate change is one where there's like a dozen sides. And it's really often hard to get all those sides in one story. Because there are people who, you know, say there's climate change, we're all going to die in 5 years. And then there are people who say there's climate change, but it's not going to happen for 100 years. And then there are people who say, yeah, there's climate change, but there's nothing we can do anyway. You know, so there are many, many, many variations of that. So it's kind of a complex story, too.
Do you have another question?
Yeah.
I appreciate you sharing. I study a lot of philosophy. I'm also in real estate, and I went to an event probably sometime last year. I was at a Galleria, and I saw one of the police officers there, so I didn't know what was going on. And they were actually having some DFW police officer meeting or something like that with a most majority of Dallas police officers come together and just present awards and stuff like that. So I saw one of them, I was off duty, he was going to be there. And me as a, I love learning from, you know, law enforcement. I said, so I walked up to the police officer and I said, in your all the years you've been police officer, what can I do as a citizen of the United States to help you out? And this is what he told me. He said, I've been a police officer 20 plus years. He said, I'm going to tell you about two or three things and pass the message along. He said, number one, you need to understand is don't believe everything you hear on the news. And he said, he said, because when a police officer has to report things, he's always getting added information to his report. And sometimes journalists jump the gun when they don't have all the stuff ready. And so my question to you is, should we take things with a grain of salt when something just jumps out in the news and it's big and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's good to be skeptical, again, of everything you read in the newspaper, everything you see on TV, to have a reasoned skepticism. And that's why, you know, I was suggesting that you know, to be media literate, you want to look right at a couple of different sources. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Hi.
So my question is sort of a blog of a question, but so how do journalists best balance the obligations that you've mentioned? And by that, I'm not just referring to reporting truths, but to how do you know what truths to report and how to prioritize that? So in that, also recognizing the power that you wield as a journalism and that you're sort of the mouthpiece for all these different truths that are out there. And is there a feedback loop where you recognize that you need to balance the conversation, or do you just put the information out there without any regard to it?
No, I mean, you know, how do you decide what's going to be in the newspaper, what you cover? You know, journalists have news eyes that they look at as to what is newsworthy. One is impact, you know, so they're going to be covering stuff in a local community that impacts the community and impacts the most people. So that's one main news eye. Like the University of North Texas, you're going to be covering, for the North Texas Daily, you're going to be covering stuff that happens at the North Texas campus that affects the most students. Okay, so a story about increasing student fees would be something that you would choose and you'd write about. It wouldn't be big news necessarily for Dallas Morning News of a student newspaper in Arlington. You'd focus on what has impact, what is local to your community. That's the way most news organizations, well, at least most newspapers are organized in the United States. It's around geography in an area. But there are other news values. Conflict is a big news value. You also want to have something interesting. That's why sports is big news, because conflict between teams is inherently interesting. So there's a list of things that journalists go through to try and find a mix of stories that will keep people interested and also keep them informed. You know, the story about Trump. You know, why about pardoning a turkey? Why is that worth writing about? Well, one of the news values there is prominence. The President of the United States is the most prominent person in the United States, maybe in the world, so anything he does is newsworthy. If he does something once a year, like pardon turkeys, then he'll write about it. Also has a human interest, it has conflict, man versus turkey. You know, so there's all these different kinds of things. So, I don't know if I'm completely answering your question, but it's more of an art than a science. The journalists have to balance what people are interested in, what affects them, then also what is going to interest them, entertain them, like the turkey story, like sports stories, and what we think they need to know, too, about, again, what's going to affect them in their day-to-day lives. I mean, you know, when I was a newspaper reporter covering City Hall in the community where I lived, you know, I would go to a town meeting, you know, they'd be talking about stuff for 3 hours, but I would only have 14 column inches to write about, so I'd have to pick what would affect people most in their lives. And again, part of it is an art, part of it is reason. You know, one time I remember they passed a law limiting the number of dogs you could own in the community to 3. And so I thought, this is going to be interesting because a lot of people like dogs here in this community, and I wrote it, and it was one of the, generated probably the most attention I'd ever had, because the next city council meeting, you couldn't get into the room because everybody was there to protest to get this dog law overturned. So you just try and guess what people need to know, what they want to know, what will entertain them, because as I always tell students, the news business is a business in the United States. So we also have to factor that into it, you know. What will get people to buy a newspaper? Or what will get them to look at your website? That's got to be figured into. So it's all these different things.
Is that solely the obligation to the truth?
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully you're not going to lie to get people to look at the newspaper. I mean, who did? I mean, some do, some tell false stories, but I didn't quite hear the question.
Does that solely your obligation to the truth if maybe you prioritize certain truths over others, or...
You mean certain true stories? Over?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can't, you're limited in space and time. So you have to make judgment calls, you know. And so again, you know, it is a professional judgment, and it's not like rocket science, it's not like NASA trying to lift off the space shuttle, you know, two stories about city council plus two stories about sports equals a good newspaper, where you don't have that. You just have to kind of have a sense of the community, what they want, and what you think they need. And sometimes they don't want to read stuff that frankly they need to read about, you know, about different things the government is doing. They're kind of turned off by that. And so a part of that, of journalism, is trying to present stuff in an interesting way to get people to be concerned about public issues.
There's another question.
Yeah.
Okay, well, first off, it's a wonderful talk. Thank you so much. I have a couple of friends that are so turned off by the news and fake news and everything's depressing, they just don't watch the news at all. And my response was, I think we have an obligation as citizens to be up as much as possible on what's going on in our world and our country. I wanted you to comment on that, and how would you respond to someone that just says, well, I'm not watching the news anymore, I'm boycotting it all.
Well, I'd say eventually then you're not interested in the government or who's in charge. I mean, you can think that things are really too depressing, they're too partisan, you can opt out, but then somebody else is going to make life choices for you. I would agree with you that we have an obligation. If it's a democracy and we're supposed to participate, then there is an obligation upon all of the voters to be engaged in some fashion. I think the journalism industry has contributed to cynicism. I think part of the problem is the way, as one gentleman mentioned further, you know, every story is a controversy. There's always two sides. In fact, we had two guys speak at UNT a couple of years ago. One was the spokesman for Clinton for a while, Terry McAuliffe, who's now the governor of Virginia, and then the guy for Bush. Do you remember who he was? This one, George W. Bush's press people, and they had a debate, and people said, is the press biased against Republicans or Democrats? And both of them said, you know, the press really is biased towards conflict. And one of the problems that people from both parties have is that the press is always presenting something in terms of conflict, and no matter which party you are in Washington, you try to get something done, and then the press will not just write about your tax plan or whatever, but they will also run to the other party and say, what do you think about this tax plan? It's terrible, isn't it? And then, so everything is always...
It sells more newspapers.
It sells more newspapers, but it also is, you know, there's a difference of opinion. We have a democracy, and again, you know, it's a really difficult and soluble problem in some ways, because again, journalists don't want to just take the word of whoever is in government at that point and say your plan is perfect, because there are other people in the United States who disagree.
Question.
Yeah.
Real quick, over the last 20 years, you know, the media consolidation has come from about 50 sources to about 5 or 6 controlling the date of the next meeting is an interesting one. It's an interesting week. Net neutrality.
Okay.
Does journalism exist this time next month?
Yeah, I think it will continue to exist. I mean, that's a point that a lot of people raise, and they're worried about, you know, like Walt Disney Company owns ESPN and newspapers and magazines and so forth. And I think there was some legitimate concern about that at one point. The way the media is structured right now, though, there are so many nodes of information, so many websites, so many cable TV channels, so many satellite channels, that it's really hard for anybody to control all of that. And I think everybody has access, you know, to different sources of information. I think probably the biggest threat to democracy right now is probably Google, Amazon, Facebook, that so many people are getting their information over those channels.
Amazon,
Yeah, I don't know if Facebook owns Amazon or not, but they, those social media channels control a lot of information that's going on. But right now, you know, just on cable TV, you have MSNBC, you have CNN, you have Fox. They all have distinct points of view. Most people can get access to those. Most people can also get access to the Huffington Post, which is a left website, and then you've got the Drudge Report on the right. So, you know, I can call up my phone and get a half a dozen different versions of Trump's tax plan right now, and different opinions.
AOL is involved in the lawsuit.
Let's not get back into
that.
But anyway, I appreciate your concern, but I would say that there are many channels out there right now.
We have time for two more questions.
Okay.
And I have one that you've been kind of skirting around here.
Okay.
Everybody really knows, even people who write history, write it from a standpoint, from a point of view, from a kind of slant, you know, they can't help it. Their prejudice kind of gets into the writing. So what's to keep a journalist, a public relations person from muckraking, yellow journalism, you know, sensationalism in order to sell more, to promote his ego, you know, for awards, you know, that's going to color his point of view, in other words, so it's not as objective.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the same thing as, you know, I think you're talking about being a doctor. What's to keep a doctor from recommending plastic surgery if it's not needed or some other procedure? You know, you really need to have a back operation when maybe some physical therapy could do. I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of this comes down to, you know, trust and people trying to do the right thing. And certainly in journalism, there's a lot of people who will write stuff based on ego or political philosophy or what have you. And public relations is unabashedly, you know, an advocacy form. Just the idea is that you want to be an honest advocate and that you want to tell people that you're an advocate and you want to get their side of the opinion out. So, I mean, it is a problem. That's why some people have said, I didn't talk about the theory of objectivity, but that's one of the other journalistic principles, that reporters are supposed to be objective if they're covering a football game or whatever and not inject their opinion in it. Can they do that completely? No, it's an ideal that you can't attain. But again, the idea is that you're supposed to strive. What do we do as a public? We check the stories against other sources.
Last question. Okay, I have an easy one for you.
Okay.
One of the most trusted news sources is PBS NewsHours.
Yeah.
And it's probably because it's a nonprofit organization. Do you think if newspapers become nonprofit, the public would be more trusting toward them?
Yeah, I don't know. I think people are just skeptical in general of the news media. And I don't think nonprofit newspapers actually are going to work. I think that's the other question. I think it is at least in the United States, it's set up as a for-profit industry, and the nonprofit ones that have been started haven't really been overly successful. PBS is supported partly by government grants to the Corporation of Public Broadcasting, and even they have taken advertising revenue recently, and they make money, PBS does, from selling Big Bird toys and that kind of thing. So I don't know if nonprofit will really work in the United States. You know, whether people would trust it more or not, you know, I don't know.
Many newspapers nonprofit, but involuntarily.
Yeah, exactly. It's a rough time for the industry.
It certainly makes sense that it should be. Well, thank you very, very much.